This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The MacArthur Foundation announced its Genius Grants today, and that means 24 people will each receive $500,000 over the next 5 years to spend however they see fit. Among this year's recipients, a blues musician, an inventor, a medieval historian, and a scientist who studies the stuff of the web. Not the internet. She studies the silk of spiders with which they weave their webs. Cheryl Hayashi is an associate professor of biology at the University of California, Riverside.
Once you start working on spiders, you just really can't avoid noticing how important silk is to every aspect of their ecology.
What are the big questions you're trying to answer about spider silks?
Well, where did it come from in the ancestral spider? I mean, we don't know that. Mm-hmm. Why and how are there so many different kinds of silks? We've just been scratching the tip of the iceberg on that one. How all these silks are mechanically different and what they allow spiders to do, I mean, that's just really, really underdescribed.
At various times in my life, I've heard people describe how strong the silk of a spider can be. What's a reasonable statement of how strong it is that is academically, scientifically defensible?
Well, there are some types of spider silks that are remarkably strong that rival high tensile steel in terms of strength. And there's other types of silks out there that are far tougher, that can absorb a lot more energy before failing than nearly all man-made and biological materials. But what's remarkable to me about spider silks is just the variety of silks out there. And so basically, if you were an engineer or an architect and you were looking for a particular material and you wanted to make a checklist of what features you wanted in that material, I really believe we could take any checklist and go out, and if we just knew enough about spider silk, we could find a particular spider that already made that kind of silk.
Really?
Yeah.
And the varieties of spider silk, there is a great variety, and there are significant differences between different species or varieties?
Enormous differences. So even a typical orb web weaving spider can make 7 different types of silks from one individual spider.
For different physical situations or different functions? How does one spider use different kinds of silks?
It's really for different functions. So each kind of silk is made in its own silk gland. You could think of it like you're at a soft drink fountain, you know, and there'll be a little spigot for cola, a little spigot for a lemon-lime type drink, a little spigot for fruit punch. And that's how to think about sort of the machinery a spider has in their spinneret area. And they use a different type of silk for different architectural elements of their webs. A spider uses one kind of silk to make the frame of their web. They make a different kind of silk to make the capture spiral of their web, and yet another kind of silk to wrap up their eggs with.
And that's just all in a day's work for the spider.
All in an hour's work.
Cheryl Hayashi says her MacArthur grant will give her the chance to travel to other parts of the world to study more spiders and to do riskier research, work that might produce a publishable article, but maybe not. The extra income affords her the ability to fail. Yoki Matsuoka is looking for answers to how the brain tells the hand what to do so that she can advance the field of neurorobotics. Matsuoka is an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington in Seattle, and she got into robotics in a very unusual way.
I used to be a tennis player, and I was pursuing to be a professional tennis player. All I cared about was to, you know, play tennis, and then also, you know, started to be a little bit curious about how our brain controls our body to perform so well or so poorly sometimes. And when my career as a tennis player ended with multiple injuries, I started to think that maybe what I want to do is to pursue engineering and build a robotic device that could play tennis with me. By the time I finished my neuroscience study, rather than building my tennis buddy, I got more interested in utilizing robotic technology to help people who have neurological disorders. Then I ended up forming a lab called Neurobotics, where I build robotic devices which will understand, assist, and rehabilitate human mobility.
And you've actually, you have designed, I gather, a hand that is remarkable in its replication of the human tendons?
That's correct. And the whole idea behind it is to mimic as much of the anatomical feature as possible so that, one, it could be used to understand further about the human biomechanics and neural control of movements, but also that it could be one day a very futuristic prosthetic device which people can wear immediately after they lose their limb and then use the same brain control signals that are used to control their original limb to control this mechanical device.
That's Professor Yoki Matsuoka. She was named a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient today. So was Dr. Linda Cooper, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins. She has studied doctor-patient communication and how that communication often breaks down when the patient is from a minority group and the doctor is white. She saw it as a resident.
Oftentimes, it seemed to me that minority patients were not necessarily well understood in terms of their social situation and their environment and why they might or might not be kind of interested in either coming in for help or following through on advice. And I found that people sort of made assumptions mm-hmm. about minority patients and then would either decide to give them information or not give them information based on the assumptions they made, you know, to discuss certain issues or to recommend certain things, or they might decide that they weren't even going to bring up something or offer it because they had already assumed that the minority patient would not be able to follow through or not be interested.
That's Dr. Linda Cooper. We found our fourth of the 24 MacArthur Fellows at San Francisco International Airport on his cell phone, which sadly played havoc with the wonderful voice of soprano Dawn Upshaw.
One of the great things about this grant is that you can really continue doing what you're doing or the support a change in direction. And I think I'm at a point in my work where I am looking for all kinds of new projects. And one of the things I enjoy most is presenting new music and working with composers and also beginning to work with young singers.
Well, what is the special satisfaction of working with, of presenting new music? Obviously, if you present Mozart, you don't get to talk much with Mozart about what he had in mind in that particular aria. I understand working with the composer. Is it the nature of the music itself that you find more attractive?
Well, I feel I'm really reacting to the world around me when I'm presenting music of my own time, and especially with particular composers, such as Osvaldo Golijov, for instance, that the music, besides having its usual healing powers, if it's connecting me to the world and to the listeners to the world in such a way that we're all learning something or appreciating something in a way that we hadn't before, then that's really what it's all about.
That's soprano Dawn Upshaw off her cell phone singing music by one of her favorite composers whom she mentioned, Osvaldo Golijov. Upshaw is one of 24 recipients of this year's MacArthur Genius Grants.